Well, let's get started because I'm going to quit at 5 o'clock. Our granddaughter is not sleeping at night. She misses her mom, so she has kept us up at night. So she's going back to her mom a day earlier than planned because I didn't want to wear my wife out completely. So we'll go until 5 o'clock today, and then whatever we don't get done today, we'll finish tomorrow. You remember that yesterday, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, we're talking about self-control. We're talking about what the latest research says about self-control, some of the things that Ellen White has said, and some of the Bible examples that I believe illustrate self-control. And I told you yesterday that I don't want any of you to ever think that self-control is going to somehow save us. Salvation is God's gift. There is nothing we can do to qualify ourselves for God's gift except to accept Jesus Christ as our Savior. Self-control isn't going to do that for you. But what self-control does is help you enjoy a more abundant life here on earth. And that's what God wants us to have. He wants us to have abundant relationships. He wants us to enjoy good health. And self-control is a key factor in enjoying those things. Yesterday I told you about how many hours you spend a day exercising self-control. Now you may think that the only time you exercise self-control is when you resist some horribly great temptation. But in great and small ways, all day long, you are using up your self-control. Remember yesterday we learned that you spend about 4 hours a day making decisions, exercising self-control, making compromises, making choices. All of this is tapping into your reserve of self-control. And yesterday I demonstrated how self-control really is sort of this reserve you have. And you can deplete it. You deplete it by using it throughout the day. And you can also do things that deplete it by the way you take care of yourself physically, through your sleep, through your stress, through your mood, and through your diet and things like that. As we get started today, let's sing our theme song. Proverbs 25:28. Here we go. Like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control. Like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control. And one more time. Like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control. Like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control. Oh, let's do this one too while we're getting warmed up here, getting in the mood for the seminar. Philippians 4:6. A good song to sing when stress is getting to you. Do not be anxious about anything. Do not be anxious about anything. But in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving present your request to God. Do not be anxious about anything. Do not be anxious about anything, But in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving present your request to God. So this morning I had an example of self-control at work. I got up and I brought my wife and our granddaughter over, and then I was driving back to work because I'm still working, and I had to get the presentation finished as well. And as I was driving back, I wanted to check my email as I was driving. It was the I want in me that was wanting to check my email, but the I won't part of my prefrontal cortex kicked in and said, you know, I won't break the law, I won't endanger myself, I won't set a bad example. All of these things going on in my prefrontal cortex there in the I won't part. And then the I will finally kicked in and said, I will listen to the radio instead. And sometimes it's very good to provide some alternative in place. And this is sort of a pet issue of mine. I have a sermon I preach where I quote Ellen White talking about how rather than just saying no to children, we need to provide in place healthy, wholesome, good things to do. And that's a very good way to help people who are dealing with self-control, is to find something else that they can do in place of it. And I used that technique this morning. And I think my self-control worked because I had a good breakfast, so my blood glucose was just fine. The granddaughter, though, had interrupted our sleep several times, crying for her mother. So I probably only got 6 hours of sleep last night. My wife probably only got 2 hours, poor lady. But I was not stressed because I dropped them off. So I was going back to the hotel room to work alone. So I was not stressed. But there's an example of the I want, the I won't, and the I will messing with you. Now, you remember that we talked yesterday about the three fundamental causes of self-control failure. And we talked about how we use up our supply of self-control. That's what we spent most of yesterday talking about. And today we're going to talk about the second fundamental reason why we have self-control failures, and that is we fail to monitor our own behavior. And this was a very fascinating one for me. This is where I learned a lot of new things that I'm excited to share with you. And the text that I think goes well with this is Lamentations 3:40. Let us examine our ways and test them, and let us return to the Lord. This is something we need to be doing all day long. All day long you're making decisions. All day long you're using your self-control or not using your self-control. And you need to monitor yourself within the framework of living for the Lord throughout the day. Are you even aware of how many choices you make in a day? Let me just ask you, how many choices related to food do you think you have made today, or you typically make in a typical day? Who wants to wager a guess? How many choices about food do you think you make in a typical day?
Five.
I hear five. That's low. I hear 30. 12. Very interesting. Yes.
100.
I know how many choices my granddaughter makes about not eating certain foods a day. It's very hard to find things that she wanted to eat. But most people guess around 14. 14 is the average of what people guess. But researchers have done the research, and you make 227, an average of 227 decisions just about your food every day. And so remember, 4 hours a day spent exercising self-control, 4 hours a day making decisions, that's a hard fact. So 227 of them being about food is not unrealistic. And so here's the question I want to ask you. How can you control yourself if you aren't even aware that there's something to control? How can you control yourself if you're not even aware how many times you're making decisions? And so I think the Bible text here from Matthew is a good one as we enter this section of the seminar. Watch and pray so that you fall not into temptation. This is the Bible's text about self-monitoring. Watch and pray so that you don't fall into temptation. Two things to do. Some people think all they got to do is pray. Prayer is very important, but the Bible also tells us watch as well. Pay attention. And that's what we'll talk about now. There's a fascinating study done by a guy, I like this researcher's name, Dr. Baba Shiv, who teaches at Stanford's Graduate School of Business there. And so Baba Shiv did a very, very simple, elegant experiment. And he had a large group of people. He randomly divided them to two groups. And one group, he individually gave people a 7-digit number that they had to remember. Okay, so it's like a telephone number. You have to remember this 7-digit number. And the other group, they just gave a 1-digit number to remember. And then after they were given that number and said, now you got to remember this number, he walked them down the hall and he offered them a choice of snacks. They could have either a slice of chocolate cake or they could have a bowl of fruit salad. And what do you think happened? Those remembering the 7-digit number were twice as likely to choose chocolate cake. And so when you are preoccupied, you are more likely to make a decision that is simply a response to your impulses, to those desires that you have, rather than the decision that comes from the prefrontal cortex says, you know, fruit is better for me. I really don't need to have this chocolate cake. Empty calories, fruit would be much better. Being distracted affects your ability to control yourself. So if you're standing in line to order something at a restaurant, don't get distracted. Don't try to text, answer emails. Don't try to multitask when you're making important choices. They did. There have been several fascinating studies done about shoppers who are distracted. Shoppers who are distracted end up buying all kinds of things that they did not intend to buy. So think back when you went shopping with your little kids and they were just driving you out of your mind. Did it impact your shopping? It may have cut your shopping trip short, and that may have caused you not to buy as many things. But if you tried to do the whole routine with those kids distracting you, I'm betting you ended up buying things you didn't want to buy. I call this cognitive overload. When you are cognitively overloaded, your decisions are not fully considered, and your actions become those that are more based on impulse rather than the thoughts of your prefrontal cortex. You have less self-control when you have cognitive overload. Cognitive overload is the enemy of making decisions, being aware of the decisions you're making. And it is the enemy of full back-and-forth communication between the prefrontal cortex and the rest of your brain. People think that they can multitask, but the more I learn about brain research, I don't think you multitask. Now, some people can switch between tasks very quickly, but really your brain does one thing at a time. So if you want to do one thing at a time very well, give that one thing your full attention. Don't try to multitask. My wife can't believe that I'm saying these things here. Try this experiment here. Whoops. All right. I love this experiment. Elegant in its simplicity.
Count how many times the players wearing white pass the basketball. How many passes did you count?
15.
The correct answer is 15 passes. But did you see the gorilla?
You didn't see the gorilla. I rest my case. And Mrs. Heinle, you can just ask me from time to time, did you see the gorilla, when I'm trying to do too many things at once. Did you see? How many of you be honest with me and say, I did not see the gorilla? Look at this. This never ceases to amaze me. Pardon me?
I'm a professional multitasker for a living out of a pattern. And yeah. I find that the men do planners are not good at it, but the women are very good at it.
Yeah, there is some evidence that women can switch between tasks. I don't even want to use the word multitasking. Switch between tasks more efficiently, more rapidly than men. There is evidence of that, but I still don't believe the brain was designed to try to do two things at once. All right. So, that's the first lesson I want to leave with you. Don't try to make important decisions when you are suffering from cognitive overload. Yes?
Your computer can't do it.
What?
Your computer can't do it.
That's true.
Your computer cannot, so
yep.
This is a better computer.
Right. Even FM radio is not broadcasting both the left and right channel. It alternates between left and right really fast, and that's how you hear the stereo. All right. Now, the other thing that just amazed me began here in Canada, in McGill University, with a couple of researchers there who were, this was in the 50s, so they were just beginning to put probes into the brains of rats and stimulating different parts of the brain to see what would happen. And they thought they were going to be stimulating the fear or pain part of this rat's brain, but they missed. And they got a part of the brain that they didn't know what they had. But the rat just loved having that part of his brain stimulated. The rat would do anything to get that part of the brain stimulated. They starved this rat for 24 hours, gave the rat a choice between going to food he loved or to the little lever where he could push it and stimulate his brain. He chose stimulating his brain over going and eating. They did a horrible thing. They electrified a grid between the lever and where the rat was. And so when the rat walked on it, he shocked his feet to the point that he burned his feet. Simply going to get that lever, he ignored everything else and only wanted to pull that lever to stimulate that part of his brain. He was never satiated. He could never get enough of it. Now, some people think that this was stimulating the pleasure zone. But after further research, they found that this was stimulating the part of your brain that anticipates that a good thing is going to happen. How many of you have had that experience where the anticipation of something happened was much greater, more satisfying than when it actually happened? Sometimes we have family reunions and I always look forward to them. And there are times when the actual family reunion is as pleasurable as looking forward to them, but there have been times when looking forward to the family reunion was more pleasurable than the reunion itself. So there is this part of your brain that is separate from actually experiencing the pleasure of the experience itself. A different part of your brain anticipates something wonderful coming, something wonderful happening. And so we're talking now about the I want power of the three elements that we talked about earlier. This anticipation of how good something is going to feel. And so this leads me into what I call the addictive power of the neurotransmitter dopamine. Dopamine. This is what your brain releases when it thinks something good is about to happen, when it anticipates something good happening. And so they did a simple experiment with rats where they found out they trained the rat to like sugar. It wasn't hard to train the rat to do that. And then they tested to see what parts of the brain were being activated as the rat was preparing to receive sugar. And they found out that as they signaled the rat that sugar was coming, one part of the brain was activated when dopamine was released. But then when the rat actually ate the sugar, another part of the brain was activated, showing that the rat was experiencing pleasure from having eaten the sugar. And so I want you to keep in mind that there are two parts going on here. When you anticipate something good happening, there's a release of dopamine. And this is what sort of keeps you pressing on, desiring, wanting to reach that goal. Because when they deactivated, and I don't know how they did this, but when they deactivated the rat's ability to create dopamine, he no longer sought sugar. But when he got it, he still enjoyed it. So I hope I've made this clear enough about those two aspects of your brain. Because you have the same thing going on in you. They took subjects and they put them in a brain scan apparatus there, and they had conditioned these subjects to know that when something happened, when a light flashed, I think it was, some special symbol appeared on a character, some special character appeared on the screen, they knew they were going to win some money. All right? Once that signal went off, they knew they were going to win some money, and then all they had to do was push another button, and then they would claim that money. And so as soon as that symbol came on screen, dopamine was released in the brain saying, you're going to get some money, you're going to get some money. The anticipation of receiving money. Then they pushed the button, and they were told, you just got $8 or whatever, and another part of their brain was activated because they now experienced the joy of actually winning it. Okay? So, dopamine released by one promise of reward, though, makes you susceptible to all temptations. This is why they use erotic images in advertising a lot. Because when men see an erotic image, dopamine is released in the brain. Oh, yes, I see something. I anticipate something I might have. Even with Christian men, it's sort of this primal response that goes on in the brain here. People who are fantasizing winning the lottery tend to overeat more. They did a study where they had people who regularly played the lottery, and they would talk to them, are you anticipating winning? And then they tracked how much they ate, and they compared that to another group. People who are anticipating winning the lottery tended to overeat. So this is a fact of your brain chemistry that you need to be aware of, that when dopamine is released and you start to anticipate one pleasure or one something, you then have a lower threshold of resistance to all temptations. Now, marketers know this. Marketers know this, and so they take advantage of us through advertising. How many of you have been to Costco and seen the free samples? Now, I used to think that they gave free samples because they simply wanted to introduce you to a product that was new on the market and they wanted to sell some. Well, I do believe there's some of that going on. But now I know that when you see the words free, when you see the words food, dopamine is released in your brain. You anticipate some pleasure that's coming. And then, as a result, you are less able to resist all other temptations that assail you. And so you end up buying more stuff than you planned on buying. Thus, Costco has become the $100 store. You can't go there and not spend at least $100. And I'm really worried because my wife times her visits to Costco when she knows the most samples will be out. She works as a choir director in Red Deer, and every Thursday she goes down early so she can go to Costco and eat her supper of samples. I say, honey, that's not a balanced supper. And then now I can add to that argument, and also they're manipulating your dopamine levels and they're probably getting you to buy more stuff. So be careful about those free samples. Now, they don't have JCPenney in Canada, but in the United States, JCPenney is a huge chain store. And about a year ago, they got a new CEO, and he decided that they would no longer have sales. They would just have their regular price. No more of this, making you think you're getting a deal when really all they're doing is lowering it to the regular price. He said, we're just going to sell things at the regular price. And I told my wife, I said, I don't think this is going to work. Because people like to think that they're getting something. Anticipating going and seeing what's on sale is a pleasure that we look forward to. And stores know that when you see those big letters, capital S-A-L-E, dopamine is released in your brain, and suddenly you are more susceptible to buy things. Now, I really am picking on my wife today, and she happens to be here, but I won't point her out. But we discovered Cross Iron Mills there north of Calgary. Now, I don't like the place, but my wife really likes the place. And she says, you know, when I'm in there, I breathe better. I breathe better. And I've been wondering that all along. What are they doing there? in that building that causes my wife to feel like she's breathing better? And I think I've found the answer. One way to stimulate the release of dopamines is through the olfactory nerves, through your sense of smell. And so companies have become very wise at how they use faint odors in different departments of the store to get you, your brain to release dopamine and thus lower your self-control threshold. If you have a chance, go online, look up the company Scentair, one of the biggest providers of scents for businesses. In 105 countries, you got 40,000 countries. Look what Bloomingdale's uses. This is a chain in the United States. They have a slight baby powder scent that they release in their maternity department. They have a slight scent of coconut that they release in the swimsuit department. And they have a soothing lilac scent that they release in the intimate apparel dressing rooms. And they can verify that through using those scents, they have increased their sales. And now you know why shoppers have been giving in to the temptation to buy, is because of what's going on in their brain chemistry. Now the lesson you can learn from this is, and you know, I failed to find a good Bible text for that. But if you think of one, let me know. But the lesson I want us to take from this is not only one of monitoring your behavior. You know, when you walk into a store, you see samples and you see sale signs and you smell things, you know now what's going on. So monitor your behavior. And so I always go to the store when I know what I want to buy. Now, my wife will probably correct me because I often go to Best Buy and I tell her I'm doing research. But I rarely buy anything during those research excursions. I just do research. But I only go to the store when I know what I want to buy. And I think it's safer that way. Simply making a grocery list is one way of monitoring your behavior and overcoming those impulses that they're going to set free in you somehow, some way. But are there other ways you can dopaminize your I willpower? By taking that desire to have a reward and putting it together with something that you know you want to achieve, something you want to accomplish. I don't like to exercise, but I do like to listen to books. And so when I got books on tape, I was far more willing to walk longer distance. So I combined those two here. So the dopamine released of anticipating getting to listen to another chapter of a book got me to go out and walk. Imagining how happy or impressed someone will be, or how you will bless somebody by something you do. I don't think that's selfish. I think that's a way to dopaminize your I will, your I want powers. Visualizing the best possible outcome of your hard work. That's a way to sort of use those, that release of dopamine, the anticipation, to help you achieve your goal, to resist the urges to quit and to continue pressing toward your goal. Let's move now to another one, another thing that I had never ever heard about until I started reading these articles and these books. And that's something called terror management. There is something about being reminded of our mortality that causes us to give in to our impulses. When you are reminded of your mortality, your body says, oh, I'm at risk of death. There's trouble. I need to reward myself. I need to comfort myself. I need to do something for myself. I need to preserve myself somehow, some way. So when you are reminded of your mortality, watch your behavior. Because like it or recognize it or not, at some level, you are getting terrified most every day. Now, when you're here at camp meeting and you're not listening to the news, maybe you're staying away from terror. Or maybe the preacher's preaching fire and brimstone. Maybe you need some terror management. I don't know. But in today's society, we are constantly confronted with our mortality. You hear about the train derailment in Quebec. You see the plane crash. You hear about the bad things happening. And like it or not, you are affected by that. And you're something within the inner part of your brain, not the prefrontal cortex, because in your prefrontal cortex, you can reason this away. You can reason it away and say, look, air travel is still safer than driving. You can tell yourself those things. But when you see the pictures of that Asiana plane wreck, something goes off inside the amygdala, inside the inner part of your brain, and you worry about surviving. And you become more susceptible to temptations because at that point you want to comfort yourself. Now, I want to tell... I don't think you can see this picture very well, but I think this is a classic example of people who have studied the research of terror management. They have parked a hearse in front of a wine tasting advertisement. Okay, so think about what's going on in your brain there. You see the hearse. You are reminded of your mortality. And so you want to comfort yourself. So I might as well go in and taste some wine for those people who drink wine to comfort themselves or whatever. This is a classic example of that at work. They did this experiment with shoppers where they asked shoppers, think about your own death. I just can't imagine standing out at Sobeys and greeting people and saying, hey, I'm from CUC, I'm conducting an experiment. Would you please take a few minutes to contemplate your own death? And then they sent them in and they went shopping and then they met them as they came out and they went through their cart and they said, okay, so how many things did you buy that you really hadn't planned on buying? And they found out that people who had contemplated their death ended up buying more things at the grocery store than the other group which had not been asked to contemplate their own death. Watching news stories about death causes you to be more susceptible to subsequent advertising on TV. So they ought to charge more to advertise right after the gory parts of the news. There was a fascinating study done where they had two groups, again randomly chosen, and one group they had watch a movie clip from the movie The Champ. I haven't seen this one, but apparently at the end of the movie, the boxing guy dies. It is a very, very sad, heart-rending scene. Some of you are nodding your heads, you've seen it. Okay, so they asked these people, half the people, to watch that scene, and the other half didn't receive the treatment. And then they offered people a chance to buy an insulated water bottle that really no one needs. But it's just sort of a nice insulated water bottle. And wouldn't you know it, that the group that had watched that very sad scene where the boxing champ dies, far more likely to buy it, and they were willing to pay much more for it than people in the group that didn't receive the treatment. We are affected by thoughts of our mortality. But Jesus understood terror management. Why else would he say, I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. Why else would he say, let not your heart be troubled, I go to prepare a place for you. And you remember the story of John Mark. As I revisited that story and how he abandoned his missionary journey, I believe that he was suffering from terror management. Think about traveling around with Apostle Paul. That would put you in touch with your mortality, I'm sure. But listen to what Ellen White says here. Unused to hardships, he was disheartened by the perils and privations of the way. He had labored with success under favorable circumstances, but now, amidst the opposition and perils that so often beset the pioneer worker, he failed to endure hardness as a good soldier of the cross. He had yet to learn to face danger and persecution and adversity with a brave heart. As the apostles advanced and still greater difficulties were apprehended, Mark was intimidated and losing all courage or losing his self-control, refused to go farther and returned to Jerusalem. This is one thing we must be very mindful of as we face Satan's temptations, because I think he knows about terror management and what goes in our minds. And so monitor your behavior when you have come face to face with the various terrors that put you in touch with your mortality. Another fascinating thing that you really have to monitor is something that the researchers have called moral licensing. And very simply, I mentioned this just in passing yesterday, but when you do something good, you feel good about yourself. And when you feel good about yourself. You tell yourself, I'm a good person. I've got impulses. And when you start telling yourself that you're a good person, this often leads you to do something that you don't want to do. You give yourself license to give in to some other temptation because, after all, I'm a good person. This has happened time and time again to people, televangelists and politicians and all kinds of people in leadership positions who have done a lot of good. But then they have moments of weakness where they give in to temptation. And so often these moments of weakness follow some especially satisfying experience where they accomplish something good for others. And they didn't pay attention. They were not monitoring the behavior. They didn't know about the concept of moral licensing, and they gave in to temptation. Think about preachers who have done this. Think about fiscally conservative politicians who get caught misappropriating money. Think about the Attorney General of New York State, Eliot Spitzer, who actually made a name for himself prosecuting prostitutes, but then ended up soliciting them himself. Think about good police officers who spend all day doing good for others, and then in the end, they give in and they beat some innocent person. This is called moral licensing, and we are all incredibly susceptible to it. We are susceptible to it even if we don't do anything about it, even if we only think about doing good things. I was astounded by this particular study. They got people together and they said, we want you to think about what type of volunteer work you would like to do. They didn't have to actually do the volunteer work. They just had to imagine themselves doing volunteer work. And they found out that those who had spent time imagining themselves doing volunteer work were much more likely to then go, when given the opportunity, and splurge on a pair of jeans than those who had not been asked to imagine doing volunteer work. Merely considering donating to charity, simply thinking about the offering that you're going to give this Sabbath, will increase your desire to go and buy something at the ABC. I promise you that. Who would like to be a part of this experiment and spend the rest of this workshop considering how much you're going to give and a large amount that you're going to give on Sabbath, and then tell me two or three days from now whether you gave in to the urge to go to the ABC? Going to the restaurant and ordering a salad for lunch makes it more likely that come the end of lunch or come supper, you're going to order dessert that you really didn't plan on ordering. Because by doing something good, by ordering that salad, you gave yourself moral license to go ahead and have that dessert. Having exercised often leads people to eat more. And in fact, they find out sometimes that you're better off not having exercised, because some people are really susceptible to this. Why? I walk 3 miles, so I'll have a bowl of ice cream. But this is moral licensing going on, and you've got to be aware of it. Monitor that behavior. Now, it is very important, and I may get in trouble for this here, because this is sort of a controversial concept here. It is very important that you not moralize everything that you're saying yes or no to. Now, I want to say right up front that there are some very clear moral issues that God has identified. But whether or not you eat that dessert, that's not a moral issue, okay? That's something that you're choosing to do or not to do just to improve your life or whatever. But very often people, they think, well, because I did this or because I did not do this, I am good. All right? I fell into that with my children, to say, oh, you're such a good girl for doing that. And if I had to do it all over again, and I got to watch this now with my granddaughter, I am not going to use that phrase, oh, you were good to have done this. It's far better if you were to talk about things in terms of reaching goals, having persisted, and those types of terms rather than to make these sort of moral judgment. You're good, you're bad for having done this. Because if your primary motivation for doing something is that you want to be good, I'm not going to do this, or I am going to do this so that I'll appear good, then once you think you've been good, once you're feeling good about yourself, it is far more likely that you're going to turn around and do something that you really don't want to do. And I've seen this happen a lot in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, where people are good on Sabbath and the sun goes down and they're wild. You know, I went and I did this at church and did that at church and whatever. I passed out literature. Saturday night comes and they give themselves moral license. And so this is why Jesus says, keep my commandments so you'll be a good person. No, he doesn't say that. He just says, if you love me, keep my commandments. And I think that the God who designed our brains knew about this propensity for moral licensing that we had. And so he simply said, if you love me, keep my commandments. Think about what God said to Jesus. He didn't say, this is my son who's really good, whom I love. No, he said, this is my son whom I love, and with him I am well pleased. And then think about all the times you've read Jesus' response when the rich young ruler called him good master or good teacher. I've always been puzzled by that response until having just gone through the study of this stuff here. But Jesus' response, where he says, why do you call me good? Jesus answered, no one is good except God alone. And so I don't think Jesus wants us all to think we're bad people. But I think he wants us to understand that we're susceptible to moral licensing. We need to understand that we're all sinners. We've fallen short of the glory of God. But we don't need to wallow in that. But we also don't need to be patting ourselves on the back when we think we've done especially good work. Did you also know that celebrating your progress can be dangerous? This brings us to two concepts. They're both about the same: goal satisfaction and goal liberation. Let me first tell you about the research. They took a group of dieters in and they just commended them for how much progress they had made in trying to reach their goal of their ideal weight. And then after they had been through this on their way out, they were offered a gift, a thank you gift for having worked hard toward their goal. And they could have either an apple or a chocolate bar. 85% of those who celebrated progress, because for some they celebrated progress, for some they didn't say anything, okay, so it was a carefully constructed experiment. 85% of those who celebrated progress took the chocolate bar, compared to 58% of those who did not celebrate. Goal liberation and goal satisfaction. Let me explain the concept to you. Whenever you're trying to reach a goal, you are also at the same time trying to avoid something else. So there's always trying to reach this goal while you suppress some other desire, some other goal. For example, if you're trying to lose weight, you're suppressing desire to eat. Now, the way your brain works is that when you start to think about having reached this one goal, your brain starts to back off on its attention towards reaching that goal. And so we call that goal satisfaction. And in the process of doing that, it liberates those goals that you have been suppressing and makes it more likely that you're going to start paying attention to those or doing those things. Goal satisfaction and goal liberation. Monitor your behavior. So I haven't fully sorted this one out yet. You know, how do you celebrate progress without triggering goal satisfaction, goal liberation? Liberation. One thing that I think we can do is, rather than, again, saying you're good, rather than saying that you made progress because you worked hard or something like that, you phrase it in terms of, I see that you are still committed to your goal. I see that you are still committed to your goal. So there, that's not really celebration, but I think it is a way to acknowledge progress without triggering goal satisfaction or goal liberation. Now, this is the one that got me the most. I was stunned when I read this. But a guilt tends to reduce your self-control. To wallow in guilt makes you more susceptible to repeating whatever it was that triggered that guilt. This really startled me. They had a group of subjects keep track of their drinking. And so then they would keep track of how much they drank. And then every morning at 8, they logged how they felt about their previous nights or previous days drinking. And they found that the people who wrote in the log the most guilt-ridden statements about how much they had drunk were more likely the next night to drink even more. This is a syndrome that I've had to clean up for a camp meeting, but the psychologists call it the what the heck effect. The what the heck effect is people say, you know, so I had a drink. I don't know, why did I do that? I'm just terrible. I wasn't supposed to drink. And then what do they say? Oh, what the heck? You know, and they go on and drink more. And so they rigged a scale. These poor ladies were coming into this weight loss clinic, and these psychologists from some university came and said, we want to rig the scales here so that it shows that these people have actually gained 5 pounds when they have indeed lost 5 pounds or maintained their weight. So these poor women came in and they got on the scale, they weighed themselves, and they thought, oh no, I've gained 5 pounds rather than lose 5 pounds. And then they had them talk about how they were feeling, and they found that those women who were the most depressed, who were the most feeling guilty, who beat themselves up the most, were the most likely then to go out and eat something that was not part of their diet. But then they did something very, very interesting, and here is the spiritual lesson in all of this. They brought in a group of ladies again who were trying to lose weight, and they brought them in and they said, here, have a donut. They made them have a donut, and then they made them drink a glass of water so that they felt full. And then they divided these women up into two groups, and half of the women received a message that was designed to relieve their guilt. Okay? So half the group got no treatment. They just went on through this particular meeting at this Weight Watchers place, having eaten the donut and having feeling full because they had drunk water. But the other half, they took them aside and they gave them some messages that sort of relieved their guilt. They said things like, you know, sometimes this happens. This is sort of human. And the thing to do is just to plan what you do next time. Don't worry about it. You know, just let's think about what we can do next time. This is normal. This happens to people. And then they brought both groups into another room individually, and they had before them a bowl of candy. And they were told, you know, we're doing a taste test for a company about different candies, and so eat as many candies as you want and help us with this particular taste test. And they found out that those who had received a message that sort of mitigated their guilt only ate about 28 grams of candy. And those who had not had anything done to mitigate their guilt, their average was about 70 grams of candy. The comfort that you give someone when they have sinned can help them avoid making that mistake again. And God knows that. Another experiment they did there at the University of Carleton University in Ottawa, they tracked students' procrastination for an entire semester. And they found that the harder students were on themselves for procrastinating on the first exam of the semester, they were more likely to procrastinate for their later exams. So there is great power in self-forgiveness. There is great power in not making people wallow in their guilt. Sometimes we have to tell people they have done wrong, but I don't think it is healthy at all to lay the guilt on them. Our focus should be on next time. Self-forgiveness and I will do better next time result in greater personal responsibility in the future. Self-forgiveness prevents the what the heck spiral into more behavior that you didn't want to repeat. When you soothe your miserable feelings with self-forgiveness, and when you resolve to change, rather than going to shopping, when you do this, you will probably change rather than go on a shopping spree. So what should you do to yourself when you find yourself falling victim to the what the heck syndrome? You should honestly identify and examine your emotions. Don't try to cover up your emotions. I think you should say, yeah, right now I'm feeling bad about what I've done. And I feel like I've let myself down. But then I think you should tell yourself that failure is a part of the human condition. I know, I didn't want to do this, but I know this happens to people. God knows this happens to people. He sent a Savior because He knows these kinds of things happen. You tell yourself, you know, others have experienced setbacks like this, and yet they've gone on to succeed. And so you comfort and encourage yourself as you would a friend. And this is incredibly powerful in helping you get out of that spiral. Think about all the times that Jesus dealt with people who had incredible failures of self-control. Think about the Apostle Peter, who denied Him. Now also stop and think, that happened late at night. Remember, your reserve of self-control is gone. I don't know how many calories he got at the Passover meal, but maybe his blood glucose was low. But anyway, Peter, when he meets up with Peter again at Galilee, he doesn't launch into a lecture about how badly he has failed and make him feel guilty. He asks him, do you love me? Feed my sheep. What will you do next time? Feed my sheep. The focus is on next time. Think about the woman caught in the act of adultery. Jesus straightened up and asked her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? No one, sir, she said. Then neither do I condemn you, Jesus declared. Go now and leave your life of sin. Ellen White writes, now do not worry yourself out of the arms of dear Jesus. I tell you, Jesus loves you, although we err and are betrayed into sin. Have that kind of conversation with yourself when you have had a self-control failure, and you will avoid that downward spiral of the what the heck syndrome. Moving through quite a few concepts here, and let's see, what time is it? 4:30. I better keep going because I do have to leave early to take my granddaughter back to meet her parents. All right. Another thing that will help you with your self-control is what they call optimistic pessimism. They find that if you are too optimistic about your chances of success, you tend to set yourself up for failure. So it's far better to be what they call optimistic pessimism. So this is what you need to do when you contemplate your goal. You think about the self-control challenges you will face. You're saying, this is my goal. I'm going to go to Cross Iron Mills and I'm not going to spend more than $50. But you know, I'm going to walk by the Bose store or whatever store there, and there'll be some. You should plan ahead about the challenges you will face to your self-control. Thoroughly analyze where, when, and how you will be tempted to give in. You know when you're at your weakest. Think about those times and think about what you might do at those times to sort of head it off. Identify things you could do to prevent the failure at that time. Then visualize using a strategy and how you will feel succeeding. And so if I know I have a conversation coming up with a faculty member who just drives me out of my mind, you know, makes me want to say things like, you know, go work somewhere else, I need to sit myself down and say, you know, this is going to be a difficult conversation. And you're gonna feel frustrated. You know, it's happened before. You're gonna feel frustrated, and you'll probably feel the most frustrated when he says, "Well, the previous administration allowed me," because that always drives the current administration crazy when they say, "Well, the previous administration." So you know that you're gonna really feel upset when he says that. And he always does. So be ready for that, and then talk about what you can do to sort of not fail at the time. And so sometimes I'll say at that point, I'll just stop and say, "Would you like a drink of water?" Because I get to get up and go, and I leave the room, I get a drink of water, and it seems to be a strategy that helps me. And so I visualize what I'll do when that happens. And I find that is far more effective than simply saying, I'm not going to get angry this time, I'm not going to get angry this time, I'm not going to get angry this time, because the research shows that that's what you think about, you probably end up doing it. It's far better to take this approach here of pessimistic optimism. Now, there are some external things that you can get for yourself that will help your self-control. Many of you probably go to bed at night, you set your alarm for 5 o'clock, you say, I'm going to get up, I'm going to read my Bible, I'm going to go walk 2 miles, and you know, you have all these great plans for yourself at 9 o'clock at night. 6 o'clock in the morning comes and you don't do anything about it. You hit the snooze button, 7 o'clock comes and you rush out the door like you usually do. Well, here's an alarm clock for you. This alarm clock here is on wheels. And so once it goes off, it randomly just zooms all around your bedroom, making a loud racket. So you have to get out. One of my favorites is this alarm clock here called Snooze and Lose. This alarm clock is electronically connected to your bank account. And you set it so that for every minute you sleep in, past the time you want to get up, it deducts money. It actually takes money, transfers it from your bank account to a charity that you despise. But this is a way of having an external monitor, an external power, helping you strengthen your self-control. There's a service called Covenant Eyes that once you install it, if you start going to pornographic websites, it'll email someone that you've chosen. It'll email your mother, it'll email your wife, saying, so-and-so is at these sites. If you deinstall it, if you remove it from your computer, it notifies that person as well. It is a very powerful way to help strengthen your self-control. External forces can be very powerful in helping you maintain your self-control. And God knows this. God designed us. What did He say right in the beginning? It is not good for man to be alone. When I'm with my wife, I am a better person. I don't yell at drivers as much when I'm driving down the highway. And it's good for me to have my wife with me. In Ecclesiastes we read, two are better than one because they have a good return for the labor. If either one of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help him up. And sometimes if you have someone, you may not fall in the first place because you have that person with you. And one of my favorite texts from 1 Thessalonians, encourage one another and lift each other up. It is a very, very powerful force in your self-control. And so I want to finish now by just talking very briefly about the final one, and that is, you have self-control failures when there's a conflict between your goals and standards. You have conflicting goals, conflicting standards, or whatever. You know, you have the goal of saving money, you also have the desire for a new motorcycle. And yesterday I talked about how Joseph, he very quickly resolved any conflict. But Adam and Eve, you know, they didn't. They had these conflicting goals, these conflicting things coming at them, and they gave in to the wrong one. But there's an incredible amount of research that's been done that shows that religious people, people with strong religious beliefs, and I have to say that they in these studies, they studied Jews, they studied Muslims, they studied Christians. They found out that anybody who is deeply religious, who has strong religious beliefs, has more self-control than people who don't have strong religious beliefs. Look at these things that this researcher found. This is Michael McCullough at the University of Miami. He evaluated several hundred studies that have been done as far back as 1929. The first study done in 1929 had to do with boys and girls who went to Sunday school and how long they persisted in going to Sunday school, until what age. And they found out that the longer they went to Sunday school, the more successful they were in the measurements they used. That was way back in 1929 that study came out. But he's evaluated hundreds of studies, and he's found that religion positively influences how goals are selected, pursued, and organized. Religion influences your self-monitoring ability. Religion fosters self-regulatory behavior. Religion promotes physical and social health that positively influences your self-control. Religious people tend to live long. One of the most simple experiments they did was they had a large sample of people, and they knew who was religious and who was not religious, and they just checked back with them every few years to see if they were still alive. And they found out that those who were strongly religious were 25% more likely, 25% more likely to be alive when they called back just to check on their sample. So let me leave you with these things here. When a person indulges in religious rituals such as prayers and meditation, it directly impacts the part of the human brain where most important for controlling willpower and making rational decisions. Prayer and meditation, good for your brain. We need to do more of it. We've become a church that is very focused on sitting and listening to a preacher. And I have nothing against a good sermon. I like a good sermon. But I think that we need to enrich our lives with far more spiritual experiences. When a person considers a goal to be holy, divine, or sacred, he will put more effort into achieving it and will be more successful in achieving it. And so we have things that we do because we believe this is something that God wants us to do. And that is a powerful force in strengthening your self-control. Religion defines standards of behavior very clearly, and the eventuality of being under observation by a higher power helps to keep a person in check. You know, the little song, "Oh, be careful, little feet, where you go. There's a Father up above. He's looking down in love." I think that's a good song to have to sing to your children, because the Bible does say that the things that we've done in secret will be made public. This is a powerful force for those who are believers. God put that in the Bible because He knows how we're wired, and He knows this would help us with our self-control, help us have a more abundant life here on earth. Also, to have our standards defined clearly is great. We don't wrestle a lot with whether I should do something or not do something in many cases where non-religious people would say, "Oh, should I? Shouldn't I?" For us, many things have been made clear, so we don't have that time spent wrestling. There was a fascinating study done where they had people where they would hear words and identify them. So they would hear it very, very quickly. And in fact, some of the words they were hearing were so quick they didn't really know they heard them. So it was a subliminal message they were getting. And so they had one group where they would use terms like God, Jesus, heaven, salvation. They would use religious terms. So subliminally, these people were getting those religious words put in their brain. The other half, they weren't getting any of those words. And then they were timing how long it took them to decipher bad words, words about temptations, things that you really shouldn't do. And they found out that when you had thought about God, you took much longer to decipher a word about temptation. Your brain wasn't really thinking in those terms because it had been subliminally stimulated by thoughts of God. Very, very interesting study. So also, I believe that the practice of having a child sit through Sabbath school, sit through family worship, take a few moments to sit and read the Bible, these are very good ways to develop not only the religious life of the child, but also their ability to control themselves. When the Adventist Church embarked on that big research project called Cognitive Genesis, where they studied the ability of kids in our church schools compared to the general population, and they found out that kids in church schools really are doing quite well, very well, thank you. When they first designed that study, I was involved in that, and I said to them, I said, you know, you're going to find out that kids in church school do better, but it's not because of church school. Even though I'm a firm believer in church school, and I think a well-run multi-grade school is a excellent place for a kid to learn. But I think the reason they're doing well in school is because of some of these religious rituals they go through, where they learn to sit still, where they learn to pay attention to what the teacher is saying, where they learn respect and those types of things. And there's all kinds of research that had already been done that demonstrated that those things cause a child to do better in school. I'm happy the research turned out that way, and I like our schools, but I think that probably the reason why our kids are doing well in school is because of some of the religious rituals they have had and the training they have in their homes. Well, that has brought me to the end of this part of the presentation on self-control. Tomorrow I'll talk to you about memory. And I want to leave you, though, with two books that I thought were useful. This is a book here called The Willpower Instinct by Kelly McGonigal. She reports on what research others have done, and she puts it in everyday language. She also has a blog site. If you go to YouTube, you can search for a lot of presentations that she has done that have been recorded. So it's a good book for laymen. Roy Baumeister and John Tierney are actually researchers themselves, and so Baumeister in particular has done a lot of fascinating research. But they've written a book, and it's really quite accessible. You might enjoy that if you want to learn about this. And he also has many presentations on YouTube that you can search for. And many of the studies that I studied, I have the original research that I read and studied, and I have electronic copies of that. So if there was a particular study that piqued your interest, let me know tomorrow, and I can email it to you so that you can read the whole study if you'd like to read things like that. But in closing, why don't we sing our song, and we will call it a day, and I'll go drive with my granddaughter. Why don't you stand up as we sing this song together?
Like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control. Like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control. Like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control. Like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control.
Thank you all very much. I will see you tomorrow. Yep, I think he has some handouts there.
We'll turn that off. What we have is a few more for today.
Okay.
This will turn off. And the 15 that you ordered for yesterday, and there's going to be way more demand here.